So item four now, review of report on liquidity sub-portfolio.
So this will be a little bit of a new concept. We're throwing a lot of new concepts at the trustees today. We discussed this quite a while ago that on a rotating basis, we want to come back in front of the board and do a little bit deeper dive into each one of the functional sub-portfolios and talk about what their role is under the FFP structure, how they're staffed, how they're staffed with managers, and kind of, you know, how we structure them the way we did, how they're operating in line with expectations, and get a little bit more into the mechanics of how money flows through the systems. So this will be liquidity. We'll go through the operations of that today, just to kind of remind trustees of how it functions. We'll come back in the latter half of the year with a deep dive on the growth portfolio and on the diversifying portfolio. Our guests in the room are from Insight, so I'm going to go through kind of an overview of the program, and then I did invite Insight in to talk about their role in the program. I think it's helpful as we go through these deep dives to remind ourselves of what the mechanics are, and then I'll be highlighting a manager every time, and they'll discuss what their role is under the structure here. So briefly, what is the liquidity program? If you go to page three, and page numbers got dropped off my copies. I don't know about your copies, but if you go to the nice, pretty picture that you've seen before, just a reminder what the role of the liquidity program is. The liquidity program really is this cash-matched portfolio where every month bonds mature and contractual income comes in that meets that month's benefit payment. So this is defined by an actuarial model. That model is maintained by the staff, and it works like lockstep. You see these reports every month to talk about level of completion, and we've been in the, you know, more than matching the benefit payments here. But the employer contributions come in. It's a buffer. So pause, step back there. The reason we have this is largely to act as that intermediate step of, because we don't have employer payments coming in every month, that can be used to match off against benefit payments. Because we get this prepayment big lump sum, we want to bring it into the program. It acts as the buffer. It absorbs that yearly benefit payments. We can then go out and buy bonds in the future to match off against future benefit payments, and then let the program run down over the course of the next 11 months. So you get that big prepayment in, we invest a new tranche, it pays down over the course of 11 months, and we start the process over again.
Kim, on the mortality side, does it pick up each month's new retirees as they enter the program and recognize deaths each month as they withdraw from the program?
The actuarial model does, yes. Now, because we're only modeling out the first few years, the actuarial model is pretty tight. The model tends to fit the reality of when people retire and when folks pass away and that sort of thing. So what we've seen here is the actuarial model, as adjusted on a monthly basis, is very, very close to our actual experience. So the first year we were doing this, we were seeing about 107%. So the model was overfitting our experience, but it was very close. It was within about 105% on the total year basis. We have adjusted the model slightly. Now it's fitting to about 102%. So the actuarial model, even 4 years out, is very close to our realized experience. So we're 18 months into the program now. I think we've got a full year of data, and we're seeing it that, I think that was one of the areas of potential concern, was how well is the actuarial model going to fit reality? What we're experiencing is it fits reality very, very accurately. And we can use that to benchmark the entire program.
But it is adjusted. I mean, on projecting out, obviously, there's a probability of retiring and not retiring, dying in active service, and all kinds of things. And then you have an actual experience,
right,
for a given period. The actual experience is fed into the data space. Okay, and then you have a new projection going forward.
Right.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we go to Siegel and say, give us your estimate of what we're going to pay in annual benefit payments over the next 5 years. And then we actually match out the first 4 years of that. And what we've experienced is, it's a pretty tight fit.
Gary?
These kinds of graphics take on a life of their own, and I applaud the simplicity of this one. I wonder if you might want to consider adding after employer contributions to put employer slash member or employer slash employee, since they're not simply employer contributions.
Fair point.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the role of liquidity on the next slide here. This really is the anchor piece of the FFP model, and I think the question came up earlier for Ed, you know, how are other people viewing this kind of type of conversation? And I think everybody has a little bit different conversation around what is a functional-based approach or a factor-based approach look like in terms of asset allocation. But the concept around liquidity is the commonality piece here. For us, really, the ability to have a portfolio that's going to match the benefit payments and take that question off the table, or at least set it aside, allows us to deploy risk elsewhere in the portfolio. So this is the anchor piece here. As I mentioned earlier, we get to define the size of it based upon actuarial projections. So there's an independent sizing mechanism there. We don't have to take a lot of guesses about what our liability stream is going to look like in the future. The actuaries do a very good job of defining it. And because of our structure of the rules around when people retire, we have a high degree of clarity around what our benefit payments, what our liabilities are going to be in that near term. And so that's one of our major advantages, is because we don't have a whole lot of variability around that, we can plan for that very, very discreetly. And the liquidity program does that. We do use a multi-manager structure here on the next slide. Each manager has a slightly different role. So we have SIT, DFA, and Insight. SIT is really set up to be kind of a unique set of government guaranteed mortgages, and we pull the income stream off that. We can always sell the basis of it, but we intend to pull the income stream off that one on a regular basis. DFA has a very quantitative approach to finding liquidity in the marketplace, so we sell off a fixed portion of their portfolio every month to meet benefit payments, and Insight really is our completion manager. So Insight follows a buy and maintain strategy, and they'll discuss that further in a little bit, but it's really intended to say, we understand what we're getting from SIP, we understand what we're getting from DFA, what do we need to do, what does Insight need to do to build out the rest of that benefit payment according to our investment guidelines? And so that we consider them the completion manager in this structure. And the target allocations are roughly 25%, 25%, 50%
right,
for these folks. When you take a look at the relevant statistics on the next page, what we see here is very high quality, single A plus to triple A securities. So these are high quality portfolios, short duration, 1.3 to 2.9 years. Just to kind of harken back to where we were before we implemented FFP, quote unquote core bond portfolio. That's got a duration of closer to 4 to 6 years. So this is a much shorter duration, more protection against rising rate environment and that sort of thing. And coupons are coming in the more modest range there, but that's a reflection of what's available in the fixed income universe today. So maybe I'll just profile each manager really quickly. I think I've already alluded to it. SIT buys seasoned mortgages, very, very seasoned mortgages that have a very low likelihood of being refinanced, and we're getting an abnormally high coupon rate on these. So we have government guarantees with an abnormally high coupon rate. Therefore, we'd like to just strip the income stream off that. That was the decision there. But you see the AAA rating duration very low with a coupon of about 6.5%. Efficient markets would say that doesn't exist. It does, because people don't refinance some of these things. I mean, they do not buy California mortgage pools. They do not buy New York mortgage pools. They buy low balance Indiana mortgage pools. And with the government guarantee, we like to see that. DFA on the next page, I think because of, and Gabe, you were just down at DFA, so you got a quick refresher on their very quantitative process. They're less concerned about any individual issuer and more concerned about the aggregate behavior of the portfolio. So because of that, they quantitatively can find liquidity in a little bit different way. We found that attractive here, and so we say go forth and sell, use your quantitative models to find the most liquid sources most liquid areas of the market to raise cash in a given month, but still in that short duration high-quality space. And then insight, I'm going to gloss over that a little bit since the manager's here, we'll address that. But the investment guidelines are going to push them into the safe mode and don't have a trading-centric mentality. So when we see the monthly or the quarterly mark-to-market, we're less concerned about that because we're not trading around any short-term volatility. This is something where the trading really comes down to once a year when we refresh the portfolio. There's a big tranche of trading, and then everything kind of matures and winds down. So it's less of a trading-centric mentality. So I'm on the slide now. It says providing benefit payments as a title here. Let me talk about the operations a little bit, the mechanics of what happens at the staff level to support the liquidity program. We kind of tranched out our activities into what happens once a year, what happens semi-annually, and what happens monthly. So annually, we're really updating the models and refreshing the portfolio. So once a year, we'll get updated models from the actuary. We'll provide those to Insight. Insight's got a nice liability tool that helps us pull those annual projections out into monthly projections. And then we can make some judgment calls over what contribution we want from each one of the managers before we give it to Insight to do the completion modeling there. So it's really update the model, refresh the portfolio once per year. On a semi-annual basis, we take a look and say, how closely are the actuarial projections matching reality? John, to your point, you know, how good is that data set? And we saw it was just a little bit rich in the first year, so we dialed it back, and now we're getting pretty close to dead-on accurate. And then monthly, we communicate to all the managers what we expect from them in terms of cash flow. So with SIP, we pull your income stream. With DFA, you raise a fixed amount. With Insight, you match the difference there up to the model. And that happens just in a lockstep basis. The money comes into our cash account on roughly the 23rd of the month, and accounting verifies that all the cash is available to make benefit payments, makes the benefit payments, and it works very, very smoothly right now. In terms of refreshing the program, yes?
One quick question. The semi-annual, 6 months of benefit payments are scheduled at bank. Can you explain that? Does this mean that these three companies sell off 6 months at a time, or is it monthly? I thought it was monthly.
It's monthly, but we can schedule 6 months at once. Because we have great clarity over our levels, we can actually issue a standing order every 6 months that, for the next 6 months, on January 23rd, we're going to require this cash flow. For you, on February 23rd, we'll require this cash flow, et cetera.
Okay. So they understand. Okay.
Operationally, it gives everybody a little bit more visibility
great.
And ability to manage their portfolios.
Thank you. I understand that.
And just to clarify on that one, we still have a monthly payroll process that we go through. We're not running it every 6 months or setting it up 6 months in advance.
I know Henry's shaking his head over there.
So this is not rolling 6 months, is it? You're literally waiting. You're doing this every 6 months?
Every 6 months, we take a look at the model fit. So we take a look at, let's say January of this year. We took a look at last year's experience. We said, you know what, the model is predicting a higher cash flow than what we've actually experienced. And we discuss it with the actuary. Why might there be some overfit there? And we said, okay, based upon what we know, we're going to dial that back slightly. I think we've dialed it back by, Jeff, was it $500,000 a month or something?
A million.
So we just dialed that back slightly. So, you know, instead of producing $33.5 million, it produced $33 million. And then we measure that. Every 6 months, we take a look and say, whatever adjustments we made to the model, we take a look at our experience and say, was that fit appropriate? Do we need to make an adjustment? And every 6 months we take a, you know, so we have that iterative process built in there.
Okay.
Because we know the model's never going to be perfect, but it's highly accurate. You know, our goal is to dial it in as much as possible.
Yeah. So Tim, you're taking effect like March is where most people retire. Going forward, when you do your 6 month evaluation, to raise it up, say May, going higher.
Yeah, so we'll take a look at the data. What is the data showing us, and what did the actuarial model do to match that, and do we need to make tweaks? Oddly enough, last year we didn't have to make a big tweak around the May payroll. It was a fairly smooth not quite linear growth, but fairly smooth growth in there. But yeah, that's the type of thing we would take a look at. How well did the model predict the actual experience? So when we go through this annual process...
That's an employee's knowledge.
So when we go through this review process, we ultimately come up with an annual funding plan. And this is the report or the recommendation that we bring to the board every June that says, here's what we think we're going to need to do to refresh the liquidity program. We had 4 years of benefit payments. It paid down over the course of a year. We're coming up to June. We know the employer prepayments are coming in July. Here's what we intend to do to resize the investment program. And that's a report that we presented to you last June. We'll be coming back in about a month with the next annual funding plan. But it just says, based upon where we see the markets today, so you know what's going on with the rest of the portfolio, based upon the actuarial model, and based upon where rates are, we expect to deploy this type of cash tranche to each one of these three managers. And we actually deploy that in late July with the employer prepayment. So this is the game plan that comes back to the trustees, give you as much heads up as possible about where we intend to deploy capital. But we every year in July, these are topped up, and they pay down over the next 11 months and go through that process again.
So are you using the full amount of the contributions to pay into the liquidity fund, or are you using any part of it towards growth and the diversification question?
We have flexibility around that. So the employer premate payments largely go into this, but if, let's say, we have a year where growth massively outperforms or underperforms, we might redeploy those dollars. If we have, if we're heavily overweight other aspects of the portfolio, we'll go through the rebalancing mechanism. At the same time, we might be pulling some assets from the growth portfolio using some portion of the employer prepayments. But the annual funding plan is really intended to have that discussion of here's where we're positioned, here's what we see in terms of future needs for a liquidity program, and here's our rough game plan about how we intend to deploy those assets. On a strategic basis, the decision, I'm on the next set of pages here. Just a reminder to the trustees, the strategic decisions involved in this were really, one, picking the size of the benefit of the program. You recall when we went through this exercise about 3 years ago, we had options to have 2 years of benefit payments set aside, 3 years and 4 years. The board opted for the 4 years, and so that's really the first strategic decision that we got from the board at that point in time was size it as 4 years, build the rest of the program accordingly. And that's something that we can revisit on a 3 to 5 year cycle, but this is something that we operate under that guidance until we hear otherwise from the trustees. And we'll take a look at that on a somewhat periodic basis to say, is this sized appropriately for the board's risk tolerance? The other strategic decision that can come into play from the trustees really comes around this concept of zone two rebalancing. So if we were to have a major pullback in the equity markets, the board can choose to take a portion of the liquidity program and redeploy it into growth assets. That does not reside at the staff level. I want to be very clear about that. From staff's perspective, we operate within this 3 to 4 year range. But we did set it up in the investment policy statement that the board could bring it down to 2 years if you so choose on a temporary basis. But that's a board level decision. So these are the two levers that the trustees can pull to help us run the program. So I'll just say to wrap it up here, there's three moving pieces makes this the simplest program we have right now. But the multi-manager structure is working well. We have the protection of having short duration assets with the protection of having high quality assets, and the actuarial model is working quite well. And I think the fact that we have this annual review and it's every 6 months of model fit, we get that tweaking in there that allows us to get this pretty finely tuned. So this program is working in line with our going in expectations. I did ask Insight to be here to talk about the firm, given that they're half the program, they're the big anchor piece here. Talk about the firm, talk about their role and how they serve Contra Costa. But before I turn it over to Insight, happy to answer any questions from the trustees.
Anything for Tim? Okay, so why don't we take a 10-minute break while they get set up up front, and then we'll
break.
A break. Great. We'll go back in to item 4, and we have guests here from Insight Investment. And the floor is yours.
Hello, everyone. Thank you.
Good morning.
For having us. We're pleased to be here. You're an important client to us. Quick introductions. My name is Victoria May. I go by Vicky, and I'm responsible for client management at Insight. And Jerry Berrigan is your lead portfolio manager. We thought we would really briefly give you a reminder and an update on our firm, and then jump right into the mandate that we run for you. We have some slides. I believe you have them. I'll hit the high points, but at any point, we're very happy to take questions. Insight, as our firm, is a solution specialist. What we do for you is right up our alley. In other words, it's a custom mandate tailored exactly to your needs. It happens to be that fixed income investments are a very convenient instrument to build solutions, so we're also a very large fixed income manager. We have over $800 billion in assets globally. The book of business, about 90% of it is pensions. So we're very much aligned with large clients with custom mandates and trying to find innovative ways to efficiently meet the objectives of those clients. We're owned by Bank of New York Mellon. We're an independent autonomous asset manager. We're their largest asset manager by a large margin, and our business has been growing nicely. If you look at our asset growth historically, about a third of it is typically markets. Interest rates have fallen over the years. We have a lot of assets with long maturities, and the value of those assets appreciates. A lot of our asset growth is from existing clients expanding our mandates. And then as a firm, we're growing globally. So our heritage is based in the UK, and a focus on expanding in Asia, but most significantly in North America, is where our business has been growing nicely. And that's where you fit in. In North America, our assets are just about $40 billion. It's largely fixed income, and a significant amount of it is, as globally, it's pensions and insurance assets under management. We also have a currency management business. And it's a nice diversified book of business. If you look on page 6, you can see just a quick snapshot of how our business has grown since we first met with you just under 2 years ago. It's diversified by strategies. A large amount of it is pensions, both corporate and public. And you can see some big numbers there. We tend to have few large clients, and that's indicated here. And many of our assignments are customized, as I mentioned. Our U.S. business has been, and our team has been growing. We have about 100 people in our New York office now, and about 40% are investment staff.
You said page 6. Did you mean 5?
I meant 6.
Yeah,
okay. 5%. Yeah, 5 is our asset mix,
okay,
in the U.S. And then 6 was just showing you the asset growth of new awards that we've been received in the past couple of years. And you can see in the columns, corporate pension and public and Taft-Hartley pension, the largest amount of our business is coming from pensions. And it typically represents one or two large clients, not many, many clients. And so our business is typically very hands-on and very customized, just along the lines of what we do for you. It's also pretty conservative. We're not the type of firm that's going to take a lot of risk in portfolios. Some might call it a little boring. Yeah, I'm sure you wouldn't, but we're not the growthy alts type of shop. We're very, very, very focused on building portfolios that are predictable and align with the client objectives are. And then the only thing that I'll mention is, similar to your mandate, we have another client through Verus that is a very similar mandate. And interestingly, we've just been awarded another very large mandate for a public fund. Not exactly the same, but it rhymes, so there are similarities. And so the approach that you're employing is really, I say, groundbreaking in the industry, but we are seeing other types of pensions looking to use fixed income in more innovative, non-traditional product ways to better meet their...
Was that a California pension fund?
No, that one's in Florida.
Thank you.
Just high level, do you have any questions on Insight? Otherwise, I'll pass it to Jerry, who will talk about what we do for you.
Okay. Great. If there aren't any questions for Vicki, hello, everybody.
Hello.
I'll echo her thank you for having us here today and for the trust that you've placed in us. It's been a great experience for us working with Tim and the team. We're very grateful for that. And as we'll discuss today, things seem to be working. The portfolio seems to be doing what it's designed to do. And we will do everything that we can to make sure that that continues to be the case. But I thought it might be helpful to just talk at sort of a high level, plain language on what we do and how we do it and how it fits in to the overall investment program, and specifically the liquidity portion of it. Tim explained a lot of the rationale for it very well, and that was actually a great starting point for us in terms of thinking about how to propose a solution and eventually deliver the portfolio that we have. And hopefully this will give you a little bit of context around how we do what we do, and it'll be helpful for you as you discuss the liquidity portfolio specifically and think about contributions, how they might be deployed, how everything kind of works together as you think through the annual funding process. And we try and be as helpful as we can to Tim and the staff during that thought process. So sort of pressing ahead, the next couple of pages are some slides that sort of start at the top and work down how we put the overall portfolio together. A lot of these slides should look familiar to many of you. They're similar to the ones that we presented when you were considering Insight back in 2016. Hopefully it's not too repetitive, but then it was a plan. It was very much aspirational. And now with a year and a half of empirical observations under our belts, we can talk about how it actually is all working out. So just starting on page 8, as I mentioned, the original RFP for us was a very good steer for how to approach this. Vicki mentioned that as a firm, we try to be a little bit more solutions and outcome oriented and a little bit less product focused. And what I mean by that is rather than taking established investment products or total return strategies or whatever it might be and trying to find a way to make it fit for different applications, what we try and do is sort of start with the desired outcome. What's the intended purpose of the money that is potentially going to be invested with us? And then extrapolate on that in terms of security characteristics. So when we think about the liquidity portfolio and its primary purpose, meeting benefit payments is paramount. So if you think about sort of the entire pantheon of fixed income securities, there's hundreds of thousands of them of lots of different flavors and kinds. Fixed rate, floating rate, fixed maturity, callable, extendable, putable, all with various characteristics and relative value traits that may or may not be applicable to a mandate like this. So when certainty of outcome is a prevailing consideration, I'd like to take a step back and sort of think about what fixed income bonds provide well and things that they don't provide as well. A couple of things that they do provide well are certain cash flows, contractual cash flows that are paid in known amounts and on known dates. And particularly a subset or subsets of the fixed income market do that extremely well, especially highly rated securities. What fixed income bonds don't always provide is price stability. and price appreciation. So for certain applications, you can't always count on being able to sell bonds when you need them at the prices that you would like to sell them at. And if anything, market teaches you pretty early on that there's a correlation between when you want to sell bonds and when you can't. So the neat thing about a strategy like this is it really gave us an opportunity to bring together a couple of different skill sets in a couple of groups. Our fixed income portfolio management group that I'm a part of, and also our solutions design group that works really hand in glove with us to design solutions like this. And you begin to sort of get a flavor of that on page 9, the various responsibilities of the different groups. But you know, I'm going to skip this page, and I'm really going to focus on page 10. It's probably the best visualization of how this whole process works. What we really wanted to design was a portfolio that could be purchased with the initial deposit, and that would pay interest and principal payments in exact amounts on the exact dates that were required, taking into account a couple of different things. Tim referred to us as a completion manager. So to the extent that in our strategy we can be a little bit forward-looking in terms of looking out 4 years at the benefit payment schedule, thinking into future years' contributions and making some allowances in the portfolio today so that future contributions can fit nicely within the overall strategy, and also taking into account contributions coming from the two other managers in the liquidity strategy. So when he talks about completion management, I think about that really as sort of being a little bit of a quarterback, where you're aware of what's going on the larger playing field and the roles of the different players that are involved, and ideally delivering a solution that that ticks all the boxes. So, as I said on page 10, sort of a visualization of the entire process. What we wanted to do, as I said, was put together a portfolio of bonds that would provide payments when and as needed. Not too much, so it would minimize the need to reinvest and reinvestment risk, but making sure that there was enough so that you didn't have to sell anything and possibly realize any losses on the portfolio. And it's straightforward if you think about it in the context of a single payment in the future and a universe of bonds that could potentially meet that payment. It's fairly straightforward to try and find a bond that fits your requirements, that matures on that date, and if you buy it in the right amount, you know that you will have the money in the bank, ideally a couple of days before you need it, and you can make your payment with a high degree of certainty. But as you begin to sort of extrapolate from that single payment to 48 monthly payments, from a single bond to a universe of tens of thousands of bonds, and layering on top of that investment constraints and objectives in terms of sector limits, individual security limits, it's much less straightforward to optimize on the best portfolio of bonds that exactly meets all of those cash flows and also meets all of the other requirements of the guidelines. It takes a fair amount of computing power.
Jerry, sure. Just a quick question on this bottom, I guess we'll call it matrix.
On page 10?
Well, I'm on page 10 at the bottom.
Yep.
There's no evaluation that I'm assuming we should be trying to make on corporate versus government, that you show in various categories the total equaling liabilities. In other words, if you had more corporates and less government or vice versa, there isn't any way we can look at this and know anything other than what you've actually done.
Well, this chart on the bottom of page 10 probably isn't the best representation of the actual portfolio. It's actually the output of one of the very early runs. It's a very iterative process. But in answer to your question, the selection of one sector over another is really driven by the interaction between the investment guidelines, the risk preferences that we were able to discuss with Tim and the team, and the overall objectives of the portfolio in terms of trying to earn as attractive as possible a spread over risk-free treasuries. So the actual allocation to treasury securities is relatively small, about 10%. It was limited to an amount that we thought was reasonable for the first year of the program. If there were any unexpected events, liquidity requirements, there'd be a good solid chunk of U.S. Treasury securities that have the best liquidity in the market. And then the rest of the securities in the portfolio are really sort of an optimized combination of non-treasuries or securities that offer an additional spread, either for credit or liquidity reasons or some combination, that can be earned over risk-free treasuries.
But to answer your question about how do you evaluate it,
exactly,
there isn't a market benchmark like you see with other portfolios where we can say we're overweighting or underweighting treasuries versus corporate bonds. There isn't a passive benchmark to compare to. It's a result of an optimization process.
Looking at this, basically there's not a role that we play in, wait a minute, we've got too much in treasuries, not enough in corporates, et cetera. Basically, we're just being brought up to date or being informed as to what the actual structure you've put together is.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I think that it's important that you have the information and...
Well, I'm not disagreeing.
That you have assurance that the securities that are selected are within the overall investment guidelines. And probably most importantly, that the portfolio is actually producing the cash flows that are required to make the payments.
Right.
What is it representing? Why is it fluctuating between corp and government? Are these dates when they're actually selling the security or?
Page 10.
I don't get that chart.
There's no securities being sold. What this is sort of an idealized portfolio selection coming out of the optimizer. It's an initial pass that shows the overall liability requirements in that solid line at the top, and then some combination of corporate and government securities that is designed to meet those cash flows. The actual ultimate portfolio ended up looking very different. It's actually on the next page, page 11, you can see the actual allocations to the various sectors, treasuries, corporates, asset-backed securities. That chart on page 11 is really just another version of the one at the bottom of page 10, but it's the actual portfolio cash flows that are going to meet those periodic payments coming from securities of different kinds. The solid green mass at the bottom is cash flows coming in on each of those dates from U.S. Treasury securities. On top of that, the lighter olive green portion is cash flows coming from asset-backed securities. And then on top of that, the dark blue portion is the portion of each of those individual monthly cash flows that is coming from corporate securities.
So are these when they're expected to mature? I said selling, but I guess mature.
It's a combination not just of maturities, but also the periodic coupon payments.
Okay.
So every single one of those months represents a combination of securities that actually mature that month, where you're getting your principal back, and also coupon payments from securities that are maturing at a later date.
Okay.
So this gets back to Jerry's point about these bonds have contractual cash flows that we're planning for. If interest rates go up and the bond prices go down, you're immune to that. It's all about making sure that the maturities by the contract align with the cash flows, so you don't have to worry about changing market levels.
Okay.
What we have to worry about is just making sure that the securities are very, very high quality and the credit is solid so they meet their contractual obligations. But the levels of interest rates is intended to be not something that affects your portfolio.
And we're able to observe on a monthly basis. We get the semi-annual cash flow updates from Tim and his team. We enter those into our global cash management system And we'll get a notification several business days in advance that there is a payment required to go out. Money needs to be available in the account at State Street. So our back office will liaise with our back office bank, which is Northern Trust. Northern Trust checks the amounts that are in the account at State Street and makes sure that when a payment needs to be made, the money required to make it is there days in advance.
Vicki, did I hear you correctly when you said that our portfolio is protected from interest rates rising, that the way that you've invested is there's a protection in that? How long is that protection?
The protection comes from the fact that you ideally will never have to sell a security and realize a gain or loss. The fact is the market value of the portfolio will fluctuate with interest rates and market conditions, but the actual market value change is a little bit less relevant because you'll never actually have to realize that market value by selling a security at below or possibly even above the original purchase price. The payments are made strictly from cash flows coming off of the securities.
Oh.
But are there any other questions?
You can do that because you buy on our behalf the bond,
yes,
as contrasted to Jerry being in a fund. And there's never an expiration, almost never an expiration of the fund. So it can stay down longer than you might like going up, for example. But if you buy the bond, you hold it until maturity, you get the interest payments plus the return of the capital at mature and when it matures.
That's exactly right. If you think about typical total return strategies where you're managing against a market benchmark and just trying to outperform it in terms of appreciation in market value, typically the main considerations there are the interest rate positions that you're taking with respect to the duration of your portfolio versus the duration of your benchmark, and by duration I just mean sensitivity to interest rates, and then the individual sector allocations, what sectors you choose to overweight or underweight versus the benchmark, and then the individual security selection. But in those total return strategies, there's really no consideration of cash flow and how the cash flows from the asset portfolio may or may not match the payment requirements of the projected liability stream. One of the consequences of that is on any given payment date, if there isn't enough maturing principal or interest to make that payment, the security has to be sold. Or conversely, if there's too much cash, there's a considerable amount of reinvestment that takes place that may happen at higher or lower rates. One of the unique things about a strategy like this is it minimizes not only the need to sell the security in uncertain future market conditions, but it also minimizes and largely eliminates the need to reinvest accumulating cash at those same future uncertain market environments. So what it's really designed to do is to provide the certainty and peace of mind to know that benefit payments will be made on schedule without really being subject to the slings and arrows of market conditions on any given day.
The other way I think about it is the alternative to this may not be investing in a total return bond portfolio, but if the focus of this is just liquidity and it's purely to meet benefit payments, you could theoretically put this cash in a money market fund and have certain liquidity. But what we're doing is allowing the assets to work harder. So they're still conservatively invested, but by pairing them with the dates you actually know you need them, we're able to get the assets to work harder than the alternative, which would have been to held it in cash.
So it's less short-term than a money market fund might be.
Right.
But you're buying them all at issuance or at par. Is that correct? So you don't have a gain or loss on maturity.
Well, some of the securities might be purchased at a discount. They're not all new issue. As it happens, probably about 60% of the portfolio is actually secondary bonds, and only about 40% of the portfolio was purchased at issue. But that it really doesn't matter if you purchase it at a premium or a discount, as long as you don't have to sell it between the time you buy it and the time that you've received all of the interest and principal payments, because there's going to be no realized gain or loss resulting from a sale. And that discount that you purchased it at,
you already know.
Or that premium that you purchased it at is baked in as part of your overall earnings.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. So just sort of clearing that chart on page 10, it really starts on the left-hand side of the page here, modeling the liabilities, understanding how much money is going to be needed, when it's going to be needed, and the accuracy of the actuarial process just adds to the precision of what this portfolio is available to do, because it doesn't require a lot of tinkering or reoptimization or rebalancing, because experience is showing that the original estimates are proving to be very accurate. So this is so all the mechanics in the program seem to be working well together, touch wood. But it really all starts there with the liability string. And then moving to 12 o'clock on the page, there we're defining in that V-shaped series of triangles, that's where we're defining the universe of investable securities. What bonds are we considering purchasing for the contra costa portfolio? And there's tens of thousands of bonds out there that are high quality, investment grade, maturing between 1 and 4 years. Not all of them are appropriate for a strategy like this. So what our research analysts do is really sort of triage that vast market opportunity set and really sort of distill it into securities that are more appropriate for a strategy such as this, and really spend most of their time focusing on analyzing those securities. And Tim also mentioned sort of the buy and maintain nature of the strategy. As opposed to buy and hold, we make an important distinction between buy and maintain and buy and hold. Buy and hold sort of implies you set it and forget it, and as long as nothing goes bump in the night, everything works robotically. And that really doesn't do justice to the ongoing credit management that goes on in the portfolio. The universe of securities out there that are really appropriate for a strategy like this are limited to ones where you can be very confident that the rating is going to be stable over the holding period of the investment. So whereas in a total return strategy, you may or may not care if a bond is going to mature in 5 years because you only plan to hold it for a month or a quarter. And if you think the price is going to move your way in that month or quarter, then you don't really need to be concerned about what happens after that. Here the intention is to hold these bonds to maturity. So there's really an extra obligation on the part of the research analysts to have a longer term view. So it sort of narrows down the field of eligible candidates to companies where there's not only strong fundamentals, but there's very transparent financial reporting, and not every company provides that, and then ready access to management. Our credit analysts, and we have 47 of them following this universe of securities, talks to the management on a regular basis of every one of the companies that we invest in. So if we don't have that access to management, if we don't have the transparent reporting, and we're not comfortable with the overall fundamental credit position, financial position of these companies, we will not include it in a buy and maintain strategy. And that universe can change over time. So there's active credit management and monitoring that goes on. But it's really all about defining the universe that is appropriate for this kind of strategy. And then moving around the dial to sort of 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, you see a box there that says external manager. And that's really just acknowledging that this optimization model can take into account cash flows coming from other managers. So it's solving for the right combination of bonds that will meet the liability payments, but taking into considerations cash flows coming from outside the system. So it's really customizable, and it's very flexible in terms of the program requirements. And then the individual constraints include everything from what's the largest percent of corporates that you're willing to own versus treasuries? Is there a minimum amount of treasuries that you want to maintain in the portfolio through time? Do you want to limit the holdings of a given sector or of a given issuer? All of the things that are outlined in the investment guidelines are programmed into this optimization model so that none of them are violated when it's solving for the best combination of securities.
For our strategy, is this meet by daily, or is it once a month, and what's the...
The frequency of how...
Of you personally, like, obviously you're always going out for a year, so is it done whenever there's the opportunity there, or is it a daily thing, a monthly thing?
The surveillance is daily. The optimization is really only run on the annual funding dates. But in between that daily activity and the annual re-optimizations, you've got a lot of things going on in the portfolio. There could be tenders. There could be changes in investment view where we no longer feel comfortable holding the security to maturity. There could be a new issue that has very similar characteristics to a bond that we already own, but that is coming a little bit more cheaply because it's a new issue. There's opportunities to do swaps there. So the data, the management is in real time and takes place on a daily basis. There's a weekly cycle to it and a monthly cycle, biannual cycle where we're getting adjusted cash flows, and then the conversation around the annual funding contribution and how to deploy that. So there's sort of little cycles going on under the hood here.
Are these purchased, you know, on our behalf, or is it inside purchase, and then we're investing into something that inside's already?
No, we are directing purchases for sale into your account. We don't own the bonds. Insight does not own the bonds. Insight doesn't have any rights to the bonds. Insight doesn't have any rights to the cash flows. Insight does not have custody of the bonds.
It's a segregated
account. It's a segregated account at State Street.
So in the interest of time, I just want to make sure you're all clear on the process and what we're building for you, and we talked a little bit about the exposures in the portfolio and whether we should spend a moment or two on talking a little bit more about the portfolio. I'll take your direction on that.
Yeah, I think we can turn to the portfolio and get kind of a guidance on where you're positioned today.
Sure.
Sure.
John, this may help to answer your question on how the portfolio is actually allocated. And you can see some high-level portfolio statistics as of the end of March here.
Page 14.
Page 14, yeah.
Page 14?
Yep. Showing a couple of different things. High-level portfolio metrics such as the yield, the spread over treasuries, over risk-free treasuries that's being earned, the effective duration of the portfolio, which is kind of like average life, but it's really more of an accurate measure of the interest rate sensitivity. And then basic ratings breakouts, sector allocations, and subsector exposures in the portfolio, which kind of reflect our current views on the best combination of securities for a mandate like this. I think the key takeaways are that it is a very high quality portfolio. There are no below investment grade securities in the portfolio. The average rating is a solid AA-. It's fairly well diversified among major sectors of the market, treasuries, corporates, asset-backed securities. Within the spread sectors, there's a good degree of diversification among subsectors of the market. The real value add here is the individual security selection. It's how each of these allocations is populated from a bottom-up level on a security-by-security basis. And that's really down to the work being done by our team of credit research analysts. I mentioned we have 47 of them. 25 of them are dedicated strictly to the corporate bond market. The remainder are focused on the secured finance market, so all the asset-backed securities in there. have a dedicated team looking at them as well.
Questions? Hopefully no surprises.
It might be helpful when I look over an asset allocation exposure, and we've got four categories, and we go down to subsector exposure. For example, U.S. Treasuries are the same, but the balance of the categories are spread out, I assume, among ABS, cash, corporate.
That's correct.
Setting that up as those four categories, okay, and all of these subsections within each four would immediately tell you which was which.
Which is corporate versus right. Asset-backed, really. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we can explode out each one of those major categories.
I think that'd be helpful as a
and make it additive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Will do. Good. If I can leave you with anything, it's that hopefully this wasn't too boring, but hopefully it was a little boring. This portfolio is supposed to be unexciting and not prone to surprises. Thus far, it has not been. I think it's meeting the requirements that it was originally set up to meet. And we'll set them to our best to make sure that stays the case.
That's for our guests.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.